Good morning, sir.
Call together the House Committee on Health Order. Or together, whichever, the House Committee on Health Care.
Representative Kotek, how much time do you think you want?
How much would you like to give me? I could do 10 minutes.
Well, you can do more than that.
Okay.
What's it about?
Cost containment.
Yeah.
Want to start now? Okay.
Can we take a vote on
Well, open up a public work session on House Bill 2009, which is mostly what we'll be doing today. Just while Representative Kotek is getting settled, she's going to talk to us about cost containment issues. I do want to point out we will have before us a cleaned up versions of Section 10, 11, 18, and 20 on Friday. And the intention will be if we take care of Section 4 today, which I hope we'll get some understanding and consensus on today, and do those on Friday, which will basically be, I think we've cleaned it up to be where people wanted it to be, at least if they're in favor of things, then that will finish our work, and we'll have that whole package of things to LC at that point, so that then that big set of amendments we've been talking about will get drafted for us. And we will get those out to you, I think,
tomorrow.
That'll be 10, 11, 18, and 20, and it tries to bring things that were all over the place into some semblance of order. Representative Kotek.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. How are you?
Good afternoon to you.
Thank you very much, members of the committee. Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44. I have to tell you, I'm surprised we don't have a bigger crowd at the moment. Maybe if I start saying certain things, people will show up.
Cost containment is just not a big issue.
No, really isn't.
Right.
Well, I want to thank the chair for his indulgence. I think it's because I keep talking about cost containment every time I see him in the hallway about how are we going to do cost containment, Representative. So maybe this is cost containment according to Kotek. So I just want to bring up some of the points, and I don't know if you want to do questions and answers, but I don't. This is more of just a free-flowing thoughts of things, bills that are up before us, things we should be thinking about around cost containment. Because ultimately, and I've said this many times in many forums, it makes no sense to expand coverage and not deal with the underlying issue of cost containment, because it will be an unsustainable system to simply add more bodies to the Oregon Health Plan. Thank you, Sandy. Adding more bodies to the Oregon Health Plan, but maybe not dealing with the underlying cost, what we pay for, how we pay for it, and what we pay for. So I would like to start off with several topics here. One is smarter coverage. I have an area of what we pay for, purchasing power, workforce issues, and just quality issues. In terms of smarter coverage, I'm certainly supportive of trying to add more lives to the Oregon Health Plan, both children and adults. What I would like to point out is that we have an opportunity here. If we're able to pass the provider tax assessment, we'll have some dollars to do some things that we haven't had the opportunity to do in years, and that is to have a more cost-effective Oregon Health Plan. Some of the issues we talked about in February of 2008 around 12-month continuous enrollment for children. We had a long conversation about why kids turning off every 6 months was not cost-effective, not good for quality of care, and I think we all agreed there. I think we should look at moving to 12-month continuous enrollment for adults in the health plan. We had a meeting with some of the managed care plans a couple weeks ago, and we talked about that. Same issue for them, the administrative churning that happens when adults come on and off, and their continuity of care also an issue. So if we're going to look at the health plan in terms of expanding coverage, we'd have to look at, I think, 12-month continuous enrollment for both children and adults. We will see an amendment to 2009 to that effect. Do have a House bill as well, House Bill 2404, that deals particularly with children. So that's one example. A more cost-effective health plan in terms of keeping eligibles on and keeping them retained for 12 months at a time. But what about pregnant women? Another issue around smarter coverage is currently for women who eventually become eligible for the Oregon Health Plan who are pregnant, sometimes it takes 45 to 60 days to get on the health plan. I'd like to see us do presumptive eligibility here in the state, which says if you walk in the door and more than likely you're going to be eligible for the health plan, let's start services for you in the first trimester. Because we have difficulty in this state meeting our early prenatal care benchmarks because many of the women are not getting care in their first trimester. And so you would say, well, why haven't we done this before? Why haven't we done 12-month continuous enrollment before? Let's remember these things all cost money. And we will have a fiscal on presumptive eligibility. But again, cost-effective-wise, you know, the statistics that we see for every $1 invested in prenatal care, we see a savings for the state of $1.70 to almost over $3.38 in savings because of that early care, better outcomes in birth, better health for the mother. So presumptive eligibility just makes sense. I'd also make sure, I would like to see us expand coverage for pregnant women.
May I ask you a question on presumptive?
Yes, Representative.
Because I think I understand how it works. It's not as simple, I think. Somebody comes in and it appears that they're eligible. Does it work that you process them and give them service? I mean, you sign them up essentially. If they turned out not to be eligible, do they still get that service covered under the presumptive eligibility, or will they only get that service covered if it turns out that they were in fact eligible? Or is that optional?
That's an excellent question, Representative. And I actually have a House bill, House Bill 2729, that lays this out in detail. But essentially, you go into a doctor's office, they can make a determination without having to have, you know, long and involved income verification because that's not, you know, practical at the doctor's office level. And then they would be served, and then the provider would be covered if on the final determination they are not eligible. But many women, I have the number here, 39% of pregnancies in the state are paid for by the Oregon Health Plan. So we have a lot of women who, because of where they are in life, are income eligible for the health plan at the time they come in first in the door. So I think erring on the side of caution, getting them care right away is definitely more cost effective. But I could look further in the bill.
I mean, there is a form of presumptive eligibility. And right now, they say you ought to apply, and let's say it takes 60 days to get in. Nothing's covered during that 60 days. One form of presumptive eligibility would be if they become eligible 60 days from now, they go back and pay for all the services up till that time. But if they are not eligible, then they don't pay for them. Or I know at one time it worked that way, but I assume this way isn't that. If you presume they're eligible, they'll be eligible until you find out they're not eligible.
That is correct. And there is an assumption that the woman would apply within a timely fashion for the Oregon Health Plan, and there would be application assistance at the provider's office. But the assumption is there would be an obligation on the part of the woman to go apply and for the Oregon Health Plan.
Okay.
But they would be covered.
I would agree you can't punish the provider for seeing somebody because they do it today. Actually, insurance companies do it today, and we're trying to address that on the Senate side. But what if they are found to be not eligible? Do they stop receiving the service? Stop getting paid for it?
That would be my assumption, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, because at least it would pay for everything up to that point. That's what I was trying to.
Right. I mean, and that's the cheapest service anyway.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Please let you speak up today.
do you have any idea how many women this might be?
I have those numbers back in my office, but I can get those for you. I've had some initial fiscal estimates done by the department.
Okay.
But I can get that information for you.
Just wondering how many really are without care, and it surely makes no sense to have them in those early months without care. That's part of the critical time.
Especially since we're primarily paying for the delivery.
Well, we're going to
pay. Or a good chunk of the delivery. So.
We're going to pay for it later if we don't pay for it earlier.
Exactly.
Thank you.
So, again, just another example of, you know, doing our, not just expanding coverage, but doing it smarter. Also, as you probably have guessed from my interest in House Bill 2122, which is the tobacco tax increase, I'd really like to see us have a really robust conversation here in the committee about sending a bill to the Revenue Committee that looks at increasing the tobacco tax, but really getting at that piece of the Oregon Health Fund Board report that talked about improving prevention and population health, and that means funding public health. And currently, within the governor's budget, a good chunk of those dollars go to the Oregon Health Plan. Not that I'm opposed to providing another source of revenue for the Oregon Health Plan, but really we should look at targeting those dollars more at prevention, public health infrastructure, programs that know we that work, TPEP, maybe obesity prevention, chronic disease management. We have a study from the CDC that says if we invest $10 per person per year in prevention, in population health prevention work, we would realize $103 million in savings in 3 years and $1.3 billion in 10 years. And I know a lot of folks, there are certain elements of cost containment that we'll talk about that will take 1 to 2 to 3 even 5 years to start seeing some cost savings from. I would argue if we start funding more in public health today and get people ramped up in communities, we would see impacts much sooner in that particular investment than we would in some of these other ones that might take longer in terms of delivery reform. So,
we just report on that to the committee. Check in with the speaker and with Representative Barnhart, chair of the Revenue Committee, and what they would like us to do as the next step is to, I think we'll assume, since 21-22 has 60 cents a pack, we'll assume that might come out of here, but do the work on dividing up how that revenue would be spent and amend that formula into the bill, and then hold the bill for a while, but get it set up that way so that the view is our job is to talk about if we do a 60-cent cigarette tax, here's how from a health perspective we would see it divided up, except there's also a little amount to be saved for transportation for some reason. But so we'll reschedule that and try and figure out a way we can have a conversation that gets some proposals, and I'm sure other people will have some suggestions on that as well. How we might.
So it's going to be a completely theoretical bill in that we have a...
It will be a completely theoretical bill. I mean...
Completely?
No. From our perspective, it will be theoretical. Our job is to put some money in, divide up the money, and then send it on to revenue at some point in time. And then let's say they decide it shouldn't be 60 cents, it shouldn't be 30 cents, or it should be $1.20. The assumption is they would use the proportions. That we put in it for that, assuming they pass it out, that our job would be to figure out how to divide it up. And so I think your point of this is directly to that.
Well, Representative Kotek, along that line of the public health, I also see a... connection of providing some stability for clinics that provide services to uninsured, because we know whatever we do, it's not going to cover all the uninsured, from school-based health clinics through community clinics, is to provide some stability funding for those type of clinics so that they can provide expanded services without always being threatened of their doors being closed. You know, under the rubric of public health, because a lot of those, in Josephine County, for example, we had some school-based health clinics that were run by our county health department. They now, the administration has been transferred to our federally qualified health clinic, which is actually a better fit. But yet, they still interface with that public health dynamic. And I don't know if the public health department would do that or if we could help direct that. I don't know if you have any comments about...
I think it depends on the county. We have certain counties that have a different relationship with their school-based health centers than others, and public health plays a bigger role or a lesser role depending on where they are. The governor's budget, part of the tobacco tax increase, did have a portion going to school-based health centers for continued expansion for more planning grants. But I think you're talking about more a direct line of dollars for our safety net clinics. And I think that's something worth exploring. I would argue that's probably... not necessarily prevention or public health per se. I think that's a part of our healthcare delivery system that might be left out to dry, you know, hang out to dry a little bit if we don't deal with that, maybe with the provider tax. But we could certainly have that discussion because for some people that's their first line of, that is their prevention because they are uninsured and there's nowhere else to go and you would rather have them going for, the, you know, when they can get some lower cost preventive work at those clinics and showing up in the emergency department. So from that perspective, it's prevention. But I'm thinking more of the population health, the public health, more of the truly preventive type work.
Then cite some examples. This for because I think one of the – we talk about public health, mm-hmm. but we don't talk about – well, what when you say population health, what is that?
Smoking prevention efforts at the local county health department.
Well, but that's funded under – TPEP or tobacco
But we could allocate a portion of this new tobacco tax revenue to increase our tobacco prevention education program, for example. There's been discussion in...
So that's a specific line item in the 2012, but, you know, X percent would go to tobacco prevention education.
2122.
Yeah,
well, that's what we're trying to find out is what are those lines?
Well, currently 2122 doesn't have that. What it has is it has a line for... prevention. I forget the actual language. It's
but there's four lines, right?
Right. It's the usual distribution for the health plan. There's the TUR distribution. I'm not sure if TUR is in there, but and then there's a city and county. There's some for elderly and senior disabled transit, and then there's this fourth item that talks about public health, and it's pretty broadly worded about wellness. Thank you, Sandy. So that, I actually think we should expand upon and be clear what we mean by that, and frankly,
Thank
give them
you.
More money.
Well,
the Tobacco Prevention Education Program would be one example. The Obesity Prevention Task Force that I've been sitting on during the interim suggests a similar program based on the TPEP model, calling it OPEP, Obesity Prevention Education Program, also building on the capacity of the local health departments to really focus on chronic disease management around obesity and diabetes. So that's one aspect. I would like us to give local communities some flexibility to fund. You remember we, in the interim, I think many of us were on the committee when we heard the presentation from Multnomah County about the Healthy Homes Initiative, which was working with families, with case managers to help families whose children have asthma to reduce the environmental hazards in their home as well as encouraging them around their management of the asthma so not having to do as many emergency department visits. That's one example that if counties had a little bit more flexibility, they could fund that type of thing.
Right now, there's one line that talks about public health, healthcare, and some other stuff. I think we're going to want to revise.
I think oral health, we totally underfund that in this state. We really, at this point, no general fund dollars or any other fund dollars other than federal grants towards oral health. So those are some of the things that we all know we should be doing, but really there has not been a source of funding for them.
And let's save this one for a full discussion. We'll get
yeah,
it.
So clearly it would be great to talk a little bit more about that. And
we'll take some testimony from folks and see what they think. How they think the money would be.
So moving on to the next category, which is what do we pay for? The bill was introduced last week, I think, here, House Bill 3259, which talks about how we pay primary care providers under the Oregon Health Plan. And I think this is a really important topic that we have to figure out the mechanism to make this work. But if we are going to consider higher reimbursement rates as part of the provider tax conversation, then what are we paying for? Are we just going to give providers more money to do the same thing? Or are we going to say, no, actually, you should pay your primary care providers more if we can figure out how to do that? And so that bill actually says we should be paying them at 150% of Medicare as a starting point. Now, we can debate whether that's the right amount, but it's saying we recognize the importance of primary care providers. Let us pay them more in our reimbursements through the Oregon Health Plan using the capacity we have as buying a lot of health care in the state via our Oregon Health Plan program. The other issues about what we pay for, there are a couple bills around health infrastructure, 3260 and 3261, which look at health care services, what we have now in terms of our infrastructure, facilities, Do we know what we're building and why we're building it? Do we have benchmarks around what we're doing? Does our certificate of need process work? Does that really answer the questions from a community planning perspective? So if we think about the nuts and bolts of healthcare delivery, that's something that we should have more intentionality behind as a way of containing our costs. So there are a couple of bills in that regard. And then we look at hospital rates. We heard from the folks from Maryland last week. There is a bill, House Bill 2006, which would create a health, health services cost review board, which would look at starting to set hospital rates for healthcare facilities. I was really intrigued by the presentation from Maryland. We know Massachusetts is currently looking at a similar model. And I did hear loud and clear that there were some concerns because Maryland had the Medicare waiver that we couldn't do it here. Well, even without that waiver, we could still work to control costs in our system. And maybe we have to ask for the waiver. But I was very impressed, not so much that they were able to set rates, but that they were able to incentivize hospitals to do things differently because there was incentive to do it differently. Right now, the way we pay for things and the way financing is at the hospital level, there's very limited incentives. And I don't think anyone would...
strong incentives.
Well, there's strong incentives to pay for things that we don't necessarily need.
The wrong thing.
Yes. So I would encourage us to look at House Bill 2006 as continuation of the Maryland discussion. There's a House Bill 2019, which would require hospitals to report their rates to the Department of Human Services. So getting at some of that transparency issues that we are all trying to figure out how we balance pricing and how the market works and how the consumers are paying and knowing what they're paying for, requiring hospitals to actually report that information, I think we'll get at some of the bigger issues that came out of the health fund board discussion, which was getting at that global budget. What are we spending? What should we be spending? What's the global cost of things? And we can't really do that unless we have rate information. So requiring rate reporting from the hospitals is one way to go. And I just want to step back and say none of these things individually are going to contain our costs. I think it's taking a multi-dimensional approach to this. I think you throw a lot of things in the pot that we think will work and set them on their path, and we're going to get at that cost containment. But there's not one silver bullet here. But I think if we don't talk about how rates are set, what things cost, we're never going to get there. So moving on from what we pay for, purchasing power, and we've had a lot of discussion about this. We'll be discussing the amendment to put back into the health fund board into 2009, some discussion about OEB and PEB purchasing power. But one of the bills that was introduced 2 weeks ago was House Bill 3262, which would require our DHS contractors, our managed care plans, and the Oregon Health Plan to use the Oregon Prescription Drug Program unless it can be proven otherwise that there's another cost-effective way. But again, expanding the purchasing power of the Prescription Drug Program is certainly one way to go. We've been developing that over several biennia now, trying to make it a stronger program. And just to flag for folks, there is a bill over in the Senate, Senate Bill 735, which is Senator Morissette's bill, which is really a standalone bill, unrelated to 2009, which would remove barriers in the Oregon Prescription Drug Program to help it operate more effectively, such as reducing some of the barriers for Medicaid providers to participate. It would also allow programs to use a commercial subcontractor to negotiate with pharmacies, and we just need to make that program even work better than it is now. We are currently, Washington State public employees are in that pool now, so the capacity of the pool is growing, but we have to reduce some of the barriers. So I'm hoping Senator Morissette will be able to move Senate Bill 735 our way, because I think that's an integral part of making OPDP even more effective than it already is.
Just a comment mm-hmm. about that. But one of my major concerns with the Oregon Prescription Drug Program is killing rural pharmacies and really access to medications.
We have to take care of that problem.
What it does is force people to mail order pharmacy, which saves money for some people, saves some money. But on the other side, now these rural pharmacies, because they get underpaid, they get reimbursed. They don't get squat for providing this service. But yet, when the mail order pharmacy fails to deliver, or there's some glitch, where's the emergency drug come from? Well, it comes from the local pharmacy that is, you know, available 24/7. And
actually, this really wasn't a problem when it was just OPDP in its original form. It became a problem when OWEB decided to use that, because all of a sudden it meant now, before the pharmacy in Condon, they didn't care if somebody, if a few people went somewhere else, but when all of a sudden it's the OWEB pool, it's a big chunk of their business, and I think we need to find a way to have a more textured negotiation process so that different deals can be worked out with different different places. I think we'll get that before we're done here. That is a real. And if you add a lot more people to it, it becomes an even huger issue. But I think, incidentally, I think it's a hidden issue in the urban areas as well. Because I think up till now, it's not worked the way we wanted it to work. It runs on the back of the retail pharmacist. So the only people that are actually involved in this is a sort of a discount card for retail pharmacies. And we need to be able to move that market in a different way, I think.
And that's what Senate Bill 735 is attempting to do. And I think that you raise a really good point, Representative Maurer, which is, and while I haven't pulled it out, I think any of the changes we make around cost containment, we should remember the urban-rural dynamic, because I do think some of these things will be very beneficial for areas that may be less populated, less providers, you know, harder access to care. But ultimately, I think they'll be well served by these changes. But we should keep that in mind as we're moving forward on all these topics. Because,
and you know, the other way it cuts is that rural communities have access through federal programs, for example, rural health clinics, which is not available in the urban. And quite frankly, I think rural providers don't take advantage of it. And we need to encourage clinics to become rural health clinics because it changes their reimbursement. And it's you know, to their benefit. Mm-hmm. But they look at it, quote, as a government program. They don't have the technical expertise to set it up. And it's not. It's not rocket science. It's, you know.
Rocket science is easy.
It's rocket surgery.
Yeah, rocket science.
Yeah, rocket science.
You know, the planet's gonna always be where it's supposed to be, and you just go there. Nothing in healthcare is all that easy.
As I have learned over several years of, I feel a bit dangerous by even throwing. You know, yeah. You learn these things in committee, and you're like, these all sound like good ideas, but I know the certified smart people will tell us what the problems are. But the fourth topic is workforce. And again, a couple bills were introduced around this particular issue. Now, this is a longer-term cost containment issue around workforce, but it's basically how do we get folks in medical schools, folks in other healthcare professional training programs to do primary care. And the bills that were introduced, House Bill 3257 and 3258, one would say if you're an institution in the state getting graduate medical education dollars through the state that are Medicaid matched, you should put them to people who are doing primary, who want to become primary care providers, and focusing on the primary care residents, even paying them more while they're residents. That would certainly get everybody's attention. The other issue is loan programs, looking at other ways to incentivize folks to go into primary care with, you know, generous loan repayment programs, or even on the front end, playing out scholarships, but there's a bill around that. And again, I think we go back to the rural loan program. That certainly needs some building up. That is, I mean, we're serving a handful of people the way it's funded right now, and that's just ridiculous. So,
Denver, you started a little bit of this, had a meeting today.
That's right.
You want to give us an update of where it's going so far?
Well, it's going, Mr. Chair. And, you know, some, I think we're going to have some recommendations in a week to 10 days about some real priority areas that can, if I can use the term shovel ready, I would, that are ready to go, as well as some longer term projects that are in development.
There is consensus that we need to have some significant workforce pieces in 2009, or the danger, yeah, you expand the population, there's nobody there to take care of them.
Yeah.
And that's very real.
Well, and we just have to be willing to spend some dollars and you know, not to point fingers, but stop talking about it. That's what was interested in Maryland. You know, they were able to redirect some dollars. I forget, was that for some nursing programs? I mean, they were reinvesting dollars back into their system. And we just, if we're going to have some dollars available potentially through the provider tax, we should start spending it, because we're going to have folks retiring and we're not going to get where we need to be to make sure the care is there.
You have some proposed amendments we're going to be considering along the way, too.
Yes, all of these bills I've mentioned I've requested as amendments because,
okay.
You know, why not, right? So we'll have lots of amendments. And I'm looking for my last one that I want to just highlight. And this goes down to the issue of quality. And, you know, I'm probably rather too impatient to be a legislator sometimes, because we talk a lot about quality and quality institutes and benchmarks and all these practices. I think that's great, but it could tend to be a little long-term. And I just wanted to put one out that we've asked for an amendment around the surgical checklist. I think many of us saw that article, I don't know, maybe a month or so ago now, about a method of making sure that in the operating room, certain things are being checked off, and the outcomes that have been associated with that in terms of you know, reducing errors in the operating room is just... I was amazed by it. And so the amendment, I think, actually asked hospitals to adopt that as a voluntary thing, but we could even go further and actually tell them to do it. I mean, at one point, do we stop testing things and just saying, this is good common sense, and I'm sorry that this might offend, you know, professional turf here, but if a checklist makes someone make sure they don't have something, you know, get the wrong part of their body operated on, I think we should just do it. So it seems like the right thing to do, and that's my non-technical approach to that. So...
Anybody a pilot? Okay. As a pilot, you have checklists. They use when you get on a 747, pilots that have been flying for 30 years, they have a checklist out there. It's not offensive. They call it cockpit communication. And it's, to me, it's absolutely no brainer.
And every time they take off, they use it.
Absolutely. And first off, they would ground you if you didn't use it, but... I mean, you would look at the other pilot and say, where's your checklist? And because that's just the way you do business. And why we don't do it in the health field, especially in the OR, is just astounding.
Representative Meyer, do they also know each other's names? Because I have heard it alleged that one additional requirement we can overlay is introductions within
checklist.
The operating room.
That is the first thing
on
the checklist.
And it makes a significant difference in outcomes.
Well, that's fine. I don't care what's on the checklist. We do that every work group we have. Can we go around the room and introduce ourselves, right? We could sign in sheets. Why don't we do that, Mr. Chair? Every committee will start and introduce everybody across the room.
And just to close, while...
Not a bad idea.
Well, these suggestions aren't rocket science. They're important. So I thank you for the opportunity. These were just some comments, and you know, we have seen lots of bills. I've requested a lot of them for amendments, so we'd have those opportunities to add them to 2009 if we so chose to do. And we have a lot to talk about, I'm sure.
We are going to be taking them very seriously and have a chance to discuss them, because they make a difference.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative. Okay. You give somebody a Ways and Means Subcommittee chair, and they get all hepped up on costs. Mr. Burns, would you join us? We have distributed to you a couple of items. One is Section 4. There was some clear unhappiness with the 2009 original recommendation on the makeup of the Oregon Health Authority Board. We had lots of proposals for this type of person should be included, this type, the other type, and it would have made the board 45 long. So we have two alternative proposals in front of us on both sides of the page. Perhaps Tom can explain what we have in front of us, and then we can have some discussion and actually come to some consensus. And we're not looking for a formal motion here. We're looking for a sort of sense of the committee idea of which one would be best. And or some combination of them, and then that'll go into the package for the amendment group we have coming. Can you explain what you have here?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Tom Burns, health policy consultant to the chair. When we went over this section, many of you asked questions about how the board was structured, what the board ought to look like, who ought to be on the board, who shouldn't be on the board, and it was obvious that leaving the board as nine officials was not going to work. So the community out there has come up with a number of suggested amendments, and as the chair said, many of them are, I would like a small business person, I'd like a large business person, I'd like a doctor, I'd like a nurse, I'd like the, a community activist, fill in the blank on the board. What you have in front of you are two similar but distinct proposals. Alternative one is, with a few minor tweaks, essentially the language out of Senate Bill 329 that was passed 2 years ago, that established the board that we are now basing all of our discussion on, the Oregon Health Fund Board. And it lays out the requirements of what you have to be in order to serve on the board, and I would point you to number three. The members of the board shall have expertise, knowledge, and experience in the areas of consumer advocacy, management, finance, labor, and health care, and to the extent, extent possible, represent the geographic and ethnic diversity of the state. And then it goes on in number four to say that you cannot have a majority of the board members who earn more than 50% of their income from the health field. And then number five says that the majority of the members cannot be beneficiaries of a publicly funded health plan. So
we added that one.
That's added to the language from 329. So that's what this body approved 2 years ago, and what we got and created the board. The advocates got together and.
Could I just point out one thing? Look at item one, and you'll see it's slightly different on the other side. But I think this is probably the right model. It talks about a U.S. citizen and have been a resident of Oregon for at least 1 year. The other talks about a citizen and a legal resident. In fact, there's no way to be an illegal resident of Oregon if you're a citizen, if you've established residency. This is probably the right language, whichever version we go to.
Thank you, Mr.
Sorry, Tom, go ahead.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alternative two was brought to us by a long list of advocates, and I am not going to attempt to list that list. If we need that, we can have someone come up and do that. But they worked together, building off of the language that was in 329, to come up with a recommended board makeup. And again, the board will be demonstrated leadership skills and professional civic lives, up to four of whom may be employed in the healthcare field, which is different from the first proposal, which is you cannot have a majority. A majority of whose family income cannot be earned from the healthcare. So there's a little bit of difference there. You can be from the healthcare field. They're same on that you can't make that your profession or your current income. And then, again, the same as in deference to Representative Maurer, a majority of members may not receive their health benefits. And then in number two, the language here is supposed to mean not that each one of those A through F will have a seat, but that in making the appointment, the governor should take into account that the people they're appointing are representative of this group. So you could have one person who's a consumer advocate as well as a representative of labor, or one person who's a management of a company that offers health insurance and be a small business person. And it's not a list. And then finally, the last one is specific. Number three specifically says that there will be two members of the board. I'm sorry. The membership of the board shall include an additional member. There will always be one licensed healthcare provider on the board. And then the makeup of the board, geographic, ethnic, racial, and economic diversity of the state. So it's similar, it's close. One is 329 from last year, and the other is a group of advocates that came together. And as I understand, and there's somebody who can answer this directly, I think everybody has signed off on the second version of the language. I don't mean to speak for them, but I think there's somebody here who can answer that specifically.
Comments?
I like the second version better because I think it's softer and leaves more leeway, but I'm still a little concerned about the language in Section 2. Make sure that we put it in there somehow, that you don't have to possess all of those, or else add walks on water along with it. But, you know, that's a pretty hefty load of things to be have expertise in, so you know, should make it really clear that it's not the intent that they have all of those.
Burgonians.
And I think in Section 3 of Alternative 1, the same problem exists. It really implies to me, you said that you have to be expertise in all those things. You know, and
you need
being an expert in any one of them is a big haul, but you know, it's
if this is the language we go to, we can ask the LC to put in language
exactly.
That makes clear.
Yeah, and I agree with you on Section 1 over here, Alternative 2. The Section 1 of Alternative 1 is better language because I think you have to be, if you're a citizen, you're a legal resident.
Yeah, so it would simply say, must be U.S. citizens, probably capitalizing the U.S.,
yeah.
And a resident of the state, and I would say for a year in the same way.
Yeah.
I think that. So basically the same language, and if we go to two.
Other comments?
What family income? What is a family in this? Is that your immediate family? Or
we actually came up with a definition for other purposes that...
Actually, we haven't. Representative Kotek raised that issue with respect to other things, and I have not been able to find a definition of the word family.
I wonder if you wouldn't be able
I've
to
seen
use
a
household.
Proposal. If it wasn't for this bill, it was for a different bill.
Essentially, it's immediate family.
It's immediate family we're talking about.
And for household.
I saw it for something.
Household. We could say household income.
I think household is
household might work for this. I think the other example was the discussion around... who we were covering.
Right.
It was family and child, and there's
right. And
that's
the,
where the definition
and that, was. And that language, looked, I mean, it was really immediate family.
Yeah.
So, household?
Yeah, let's make sure we get that from... The LC gave us a language that seemed
okay.
Very... That's true. This would be a... Where are we?
Household income. Right here. The
majority of whose household income. I think there is a definition of that. Okay. That's great. Let's just change that. We'll ask LC whether... I'm sensing we're going towards the second alternative.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I just want to compliment... I think the original... In fact, I'm harking back to 329 and listening to people say... You know, we went through this in 329, in that process, that this allows a lot of flexibility for the appointments, but yet I think it addresses most of those issues, and I think this is a pretty good compromise.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, is that Kotek and then is that Cannon?
So I have a question about Section 3 on Alternative 2. Do we have a definition for a licensed healthcare provider? And we might. I mean, we got one spot for a licensed healthcare provider. I would not want to presume that's a physician. I would not presume that's a nurse. That could be an acupuncturist, as far as I'm concerned. Is that true or not?
I think you could read it your way, but I didn't write these words. And like I said, there is somebody here who may be able to speak for the coalition.
Elena Gwinney?
That.
Yeah, why don't you come up and say what you thought about it, where it came from.
But license, I mean, so we are excluding those non-licensed counselors.
That's right. I would just, okay. I mean, my read, when I looked at it, I would say anybody licensed by one of our health occupation licensing boards. But what did
and
you have?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kotek, our concern was that just saying... Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Ilana Guinea. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I was... working with the other advocate groups and some other groups that are not involved with the advocate table but who had an interest in this specific piece of the bill. We were concerned that just
what does it mean is the question. That's what we're asking.
Yes. It could mean, like Representative Kotek said, anybody who is of a licensed healthcare profession. What we wanted to ensure was that there was somebody on the board who had actually practiced healthcare before.
I understand what your concern is. The question is, you intended this to mean a physical therapist with a license, a nurse midwife?
We did not want to list any specific profession because then you get into the concerns that you had. My assumption in writing it was that most of the time that would be either a doctor or a nurse. By the exact language listed there, it could be any licensed professional. And that's, I think, something that would have to be brought up with LC to figure out the best way to draft it, depending on what your interests are.
We just want to make sure what the intent was. If the intent was any licensed professional, it's pretty clear.
It doesn't say licensed, and under this, I'd say yes, Ron qualifies because he
licensed.
Runs a clinic.
Oh, we're section licensed. Three. Section three.
Oh, excuse me. Where are we then? Oh, down there. What about expertise in healthcare? That was okay.
I think that is open.
I'm sorry, here we're talking about off base.
I think it does mean in.
Yeah.
Deftly written, yeah. I might say.
Yeah, I think it's a point. Representative Cannon, you're next.
And then Ben.
I think I'm glad that both of these alternatives reflect the language in 329, which I think was a very good starting point. I'm surprised, you know, my sense is that a lot of time has gone in on advocates' part into this section, and ultimately, of course, this will be up to the governor and the legislature, and they're going to get the kind of board that they want to have with the kind of policies that come from governor and legislators. But
these board members, incidentally, are confirmed by the Senate. Right. From another section.
Right. I think graphical presentation makes a difference, and frankly, when I see the list here of A through F under 2, I think it does suggest a place for, I know that's not what the language says, but it reads more like a spot for each of these members than it does when it's, I'll be okay with alternative 2. I would have preferred to see it remain in a paragraph form rather than bullet pointed, but, you know, that's...
Put in a paragraph. That's an easy one.
I'd be fine with that.
I think actually that'll be a stylist version under the VLC. You'll figure that out.
Yeah. Okay.
That was my thing. I looked at the other, at three on the other side, and it's the same thing in a paragraph form.
Yeah.
As opposed to this.
Well, except they've added management of a company that offers health insurance to their employees, and I think when you get to that, that's a phrase that's that long. Is easier to read if it's a separate line. I think that might have been why they went to the A, B, C, D, E, F. But these are minor points. I am okay with alternative 2, and that's. I'll be quiet.
We could get Representative Harker on this, and he could meet four of those criteria. Right? He could meet four of those criteria. Representative Denver?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, Alana, going back to number 3, so when it says an additional member, what exactly were you thinking there? Were you thinking that would be not one of the above, or is the thinking that it would include at least one person who is a licensed practitioner?
That would, both of those, that the board at all times should have somebody who is a licensed healthcare provider, and that person should not be on the board to represent any other specific interest or area of expertise, that should really be their focus as a board member. This is not, because I've been asked the question before, an additional member of the board. This is one of the nine. Our intent in that language was not to expand the board, but just to signify that this person was not somebody who qualified one of the criteria laid out in Section 2.
Oh, they're going to want us to take out an additional. There's no question about that. I mean, the LC, because that'll confuse whether it's a 9-member board or a 10-member board,
yeah.
And I'm sure that'll come out. But
yeah.
But your thinking was that practitioner could also represent healthcare, right?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Dembro, that actually was not the thinking. The thinking was that it would be somebody separate from the person with expertise in healthcare. Since somebody with expertise in healthcare is a broad category and could include another provider who was licensed or not, or any other person who has experience in the healthcare industry.
Anybody imagine a governor appointing a board that the only person who knew anything about healthcare was the licensed physical therapist? That defies logic.
Do we have to answer that?
Yeah. You have to. We're going to take a poll on that one.
One of the reasons I like that is that it would be nice to have at least one person on that board that works to try to keep people who are ill and treat. I mean, it's that one-on-one, someone who's actually dealing with real-life people. Not that anyone in the healthcare industry. You might get a policy person, for example, or something who hasn't treated someone in years. I mean, I think that kind of on the ground, here's what people are dealing with, regardless of what profession is really helpful.
And Chair Greenlee, Representative Kotek.
Like Dr. Beach.
Right? No, that's not true.
No, he's not a fake doctor. That is true. Every weekend.
This is publicly aired.
Every podcast.
He's a real doctor.
Every weekend he's a real
just
doctor.
Just doesn't play one on TV. No.
During the week he's a fake doctor. Actually, he isn't even that here,
no,
is he?
He doesn't.
I think she was going to respond to that.
I just wanted to mention, Chair Greenlee and Representative Kotek, that that is why we added that section, was so that the person with expertise in healthcare was not a policy expert or somebody else who didn't have that practical experience.
Thank you.
Yeah, underground experience with health. Mr. We all have experience with healthcare, but it's from the other side of the room. Yeah. Huh?
Mr. Chair, if I might also raise an issue on number three, do you want the licensee to be an active licensee that is actively practicing, or are you looking for a retired person?
Hmm. That says who is a licensed healthcare provider, somebody retired. Is not,
but you could still have a license and not be practicing.
I think he's correct, because I have an inactive license as a psychologist. I'm a licensed psychologist, but I'm inactive in my status.
We could probably keep you on the board.
Oh, God. I don't think I've been that bad.
You'd probably qualify if you can get by the Senate.
I think active would get at that intent.
But active, I think that's
fine. That's great. Do I really sense we're talking about alternative two, since that's all the ones were?
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, if I can recap, it is sentence one from alternative one to replace sentence one of alternative two.
Yep.
We're going to, under C, change the word family to household income. We're going to write number two, potentially with a paragraph or tell counsel it's the list of ors, not a list of ands. Number three.
Excuse me. It's not necessarily mutually exclusive. Ors implies it's exclusive.
Yeah.
It's and or.
Yeah, I tried that, and they told me you can't.
Yeah,
write
I know
and
it.
Or.
So, but I mean, it'll. But
can you imagine somebody that met all of these criteria? That would be something.
No.
It'd be a wonky bunch.
Right. We'll change number three to make it clear that it will be at least one member of the board shall be.
Okay.
A licensed active health practitioner.
Who holds an active license?
Who holds an active license?
Who holds an active license as a health care provider?
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
We'll go with this.
Okay. Thank
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, Lena. Well, Tom, you want to talk to us about the next thing?
Mr. Chair, members, when we originally drafted 2009, the Health Fund Board had recommended that, I said that right, the Health Fund Board had recommended that there be three subcommittees of the Health Fund Board. We looked at that and had some concern initially about what it meant to have those. It had become clear that one of those subcommittees needs to be activated as a subcommittee of the board, and that is for the public health benefit purchasers. As you recall, we're talking about moving the PEB, the OEB, and other groups into the authority as well as potentially into the exchange. And it was felt that if we are going to do that, that there needs to be a group that is focused exclusively on the benefit of, on creating a benefit, creating a health plan, creating a program for public employees. And so what you have in front of you is some language that, again, has come from the advocates, recreating the Public Health Benefit Purchasers Committee, defining who should be on that committee, defining what their work project is and what their goals are and how they're going to interact with the authority and the board.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question of clarification. Is this intended for Section 8 of the bill?
gotcha.
It would be, I think, in Section 5. No, I don't know where this is. I don't have a bill in front of me.
I have
you have the section.
I have the amendment. I mean, this is where the three were originally.
Yes,
original.
Yes,
okay.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank
but
you. That may not be in the same place either.
Right.
Not fair. I don't have my notebook's over there. Can I go get my
you
cheat
don't know all 120 seconds.
Really?
While other people are cogitating, can I take a editorial swipe? I, except for sloppy modern use, Shall be comprised of is
here,
not
here.
Correct. Shall comprise or shall be composed of?
I'm sorry, where are you,
take
Mr.
your
Chair?
Pick. I'm taking the first sentence A that jumped out at me.
And I believe LC uses shall include. So
the committee shall comprise representatives from or shall
include.
Include or shall be composed of. Not comprised of. Although I understand in some of the modern dictionaries that's an okay use.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with your insistence on standards here.
Yeah, even archaic ones.
there's an important distinction, actually, which is, I think if my memory serves, shall comprise at least would imply that that is the extent of the committee, and perhaps that's the intention. Here.
Well, no. Well, or composed of is the same.
Same thing.
Yeah, comprise means be composed.
You got
so there are no additional.
If you say
include,
that's more. That's right.
More that's open-ended.
Okay. Composed of,
Mr. Chair,
or comprise is the intention is to have these.
Comprised is my word. For some reason, I read what was originally written. Was originally written and changed it because I'm a product of the California school system, not the Oregon school system. We did not learn as much here down there, and so I would suggest you bring the proponent up and ask her what there was a reason why I did that, and I for the
she's hanging in right behind.
I'm sure
you,
she
so.
Is.
Why don't you come on and join the table, please?
Yes, I'm a result of the Prop 13.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Felisa Higgins, and I'm the political director at SEAU 49, and I'm a product of Measure 5 here in the Oregon. I think it's the board should include representatives of.
And perhaps others, then?
And perhaps others. Actually, we...
includes fine.
Chair Greenlick, we also... we forgot to include OMAP. In the list as well.
I'm sorry.
Chair Greenlick, we forgot to include OMAP in the list as well, which was just pointed out to me by an advocate in the audience.
OMAP, did you say, or OMIP?
DMAP. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, could we talk about that? Because having served on the as co-chairing of the Medicaid Advisory Committee, it seems odd to me that we're bringing in DMAP and the health plan. So it may be, correct me if I'm wrong here, if the goal here is to, I see that as a separate thing. Not that we shouldn't be talking about it, but really this is a group of folks who we are purchasing health care. And I don't know if even I'd put OMIP in here, but I can kind of see why OMIP is here. But that's a lot different than PEB and OEB and local county covering plans. I mean, when you bring in the and for the defense of the Medicaid Advisory Committee members, they're all volunteers, and I think the time commitment to serving on this and serving on the MAC would be just prohibitive for folks. So if you're insisting on having some Medicaid alignment there, I wouldn't pick the MAC folks because I think that's just too much on their plate.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Kotek, our intention is to capture, has been to capture everyone who does public purchasing in this state. So we may have missed groups, I think, that have been pointed out that we would like to invite as well. The Department of Corrections also does some healthcare purchasing.
Oh, that's a whole different.
So the intent is to have a broad coalition to gather best practices around purchasing and contracting of healthcare.
These aren't public purchasers. These are public health benefit purchasers.
Yes.
So, I mean, Medicaid. I mean, it seemed to me Medicaid and anything else really shouldn't be a part of this. If we really are talking on the benefit side. We're talking about all this other stuff in other places. But I heard that the PEB and the OMEP people wanted to make sure, and other public employers, wanted to make sure that their benefit plans were represented in the council, and that's what this was intended to do. So, I mean, I don't see why OMIP is in there at all. OMIP.
Mr. Chair, I would agree. This is about political subdivisions of the state and about the purchasing of health insurance
for their employees.
For their employees.
I agree.
Yeah. That's what it feels like it should be to me.
Mm-hmm.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, no, it does not cause us big problems at all.
And the other is private nonprofits?
I would say, I mean, it would seem to me that 3, 4, And 9 should be out.
Oh. Actually, may I make a case for 9? If I
okay.
It'd be interested to allow them to participate because 80%+ of money that goes out through DHS goes to contracted to providers. Now, some of that goes to political subdivisions, counties, and whatever. But we've got a host of nonprofits out there who are, by default, providing care through state-funded, you know, state streams of money. And they are trying desperately to make sure their folks have health care.
Their employees?
Yes, their employees. Right, their employees.
Their employees.
And so,
like, say,
because,
the Northwest Health Foundation.
Right, well, for
like
some
that.
Of these nonprofits, the bulk of their pay comes from the state. Now, you can debate whether that's good or bad. And then they have folks who they are employed are trying to cover with, and some don't have health benefits, some do. And so if they had the option of potentially participating in a pool, I think that's a benefit.
So these might be public funded, actually,
yes.
in that sense.
Private nonprofits, but primarily publicly funded.
Public funded.
Yes.
Yeah.
A lot of these are the mental health providers.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so perhaps the language could specify that we're talking about largely public funded nonprofits
that receive a significant portion of public funding.
But isn't this a place where perhaps less specificity is better than more? Because if we're going to this include language, then we really only need to call out the people we absolutely want to make sure at the table, knowing that others are welcome to show up. I mean, I don't know if we have the language to that effect, but one would assume that a private nonprofit who receives the bulk of their money through the public would be welcome to sit at the table.
So 3 and 4 would come out. Would you explain why PERS is included in this?
I'm sorry, Representative Greenlee, can you please repeat the question?
Why PERS is included?
The Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, PERS also does a purchasing of health care for employees who are retired
for
from the state.
Retired public employee.
Yes.
Okay. That's not through PEB, that's through PERS?
No, PERS does that separately, yes.
Ah, okay. All right.
Yeah, I just found that out as well, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee.
Sorry?
I just found that out as well, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee.
Lots of things
like that. My education. But PEB had, I mean, when you look at their pay rate or premium schedules, they have a section for, of course, for part-time and then retirees. But that's different than the PERS. PERS you don't have to buy through PEB. You can go through something else. Or are these Medicare secondaries, which we PEB doesn't do?
PERS, though, can be bridge coverage. Right?
Bridge coverage?
I mean, well, PEB. Is that PEB?
PEB would be bridge coverage, but once you hit Medicare, then the ball game's different, and now you're looking for secondary coverage, right?
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, my understanding from the Public Employees Benefit Board, who wasn't able to be here today, was that once that you are eligible for your PERS and your Medicare, that this would be supplemental coverage or additional coverage to your Medicare that PERS purchases that PEB does not purchase, which was, as I said, news to me as well.
Okay.
You have great. A board. You have a PEB board member in the room. If you want to get really down to the.
Well, I know we have a PEB board member. We don't have a PERS board member. But that's easy.
Many of those are dependents that are covered by that supplemental and PERS as well.
Many of the which?
The PERS retiree coverage. Some of it's dependents as well.
Great. And okay. Mr. Chair, there are many PERS retirees who are not former state employees, you know, and would not be getting their insurance through PEB.
PEB.
That is true.
Like school
teachers,
yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the Health Fund Board's report, and they, under their Building Block 3 Unify Purchasing Power, the first strategy is to develop and implement uniform contract standards and policies for the state of Oregon. I think that's what we're after.
You're going to find that in a different section of the stuff you look at on Friday. We actually have that in.
Okay, but I think this is necessary, or this would be a part of that effort, this table would help.
Not, yeah.
And they do, I mean, when they, the discussion in here does lump the Oregon Health Plan with PEB and OEP, saying the bigger the pool, the better.
There isn't any question we're talking about getting all these people into a pool. The question is whether the PEB and OWEB people wanted a special counsel to look at things as it related to them. I mean, the reason I recommended taking it out in the first place is because everybody's going to be in that pool, but there was some real interest in just making sure there was a place where this could be heard. And that's why I came back in at...
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon. Our goal around this amendment, there were some concerns raised by, I think that you heard them from various groups who were listed under this amendment. I think that some of those groups have signed off on this amendment as well, including the Association of Oregon Counties, the League of Oregon Cities, AFT, SEIU, OEA. So the goal of this amendment was to have those groups come together under the Purchasers Coalition, learn best practices from each other, figure out if there's a possible way that they can do joint contracting and rating together, sort of as that, and then progress that forward to report that out before sort of lumping everyone into a pool, which I think is the end goal of the health authority, but making sure that that's a streamlined way of doing that so that all of the different issues that were raised, including contract expiration times, benefit plan design, et cetera, could be taken into account.
Good. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if we go to the first full paragraph underneath the list, I like the language, but I would request timelines for sentence. The second line says the Public Purchasers Committee shall identify and recommend to the board, blah, blah, blah. I'd like a by certain date. And then down a little further, it says the committee shall develop an action plan for ongoing blah, blah, blah. I'd like by a certain date on both of those items. So, I don't know what those dates should be, but one of the, I think, the hallmarks of 329 was we had time certain things. So, and
given this is a subcommittee of the board and therefore will be focused exclusively on this, it seems reasonable that in time for your 2011 legislative session.
Just out of curiosity, though, that the assumption is that this Oregon Health Authority is not sunsetting.
Correct.
Right. And that this committee would not be sunset.
That's right.
And therefore, this is a continuous process.
I would agree. In fact, I think you go into Section B there would be a lot of work even after initial recommendations or an action plan to make this actually happen. But I think the importance of this particular recommendation of the Health Fund Board merits making sure that before we come back in 2011, this is actually at least we have recommendations and a plan.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree with you. It wouldn't sunset. There'd still be work for this group once a plan had been approved. I mean, this is a significant amount of work, I think, to actually make it happen.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, we had the original group reporting to the legislature in 2011. So.
And I realize why it's not in here, because you will find in Section 10, when you review it, that there is a date by which this group must report. So that's I knew there was a reason why it wasn't in here.
Oh, along with many other things or something?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair,
we can put it.
The idea that the work towards uniformity shouldn't increase the cost for individual public purchasers, you know, I understand the importance of that. But it is possible that it could increase some costs in the short term, as we're, kind of transitioning to something that's going to be long-term and sustainable, right? I mean, is that consistent with the intent?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Dembro, I would, speaking from SEIU's perspective, other folks are in the audience who can talk about their perspective as well, but we have been, I think, asked many times by the legislative body, by the governor's office, to attempt to contain our health care costs. We believe as a labor union, we've tried to do yeoman's work in that area.
Yo people's work
in that area.
Yo people.
And I can't believe I just said that. So
by the record,
you could take that off.
Things sometimes get wacky in my committee. No question about that.
So we wanted to include that perspective because we feel like we've attempted to do that, we'll continue to do that, and we should figure out how to maintain or even lower our costs throughout this process.
I have a huge problem with that, and I suppose you do. I mean, when you start pooling things,
right,
you're in a social insurance model, you're pooling things that sometimes one subsegment for one reason or another has a lower than average cost and one higher, and it's usually because of the difference in risk, not because of anything magic. You know, if you have a group that's mostly young compared to a group that's mostly old, their cost is going to go up. And this, I think, is model. This sentence is a huge problem for me. We're having that fight right now in OWEB, and we're going to have it again in some other issues before we're done.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if you could address your concern by simply putting a period after the word costs. And
that's
while
fine.
Overall
health
care doesn't go up, as you point out, there may be some winners and losers as you ultimately go down the line and bring more and more people into the pool.
I mean, we can do something that would save 10% overall for public employees, and there's one group that has a higher rate. It seems to me we have to be prepared to do that and maybe find some way to equalize that or create equity, but it's a problem. I would much prefer that, Tom. Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure exactly how to word this, but I mean, I think our goal is to lower, you know, the overall costs and to minimize, you know, any costs that individual groups have as they're working towards, you know, transitioning into the new system.
Well, I would even be comfortable with that, toward minimizing increased costs for individuals, even that. But I don't see how you can avoid it.
What? Increasing?
I don't see how anywhere you can start pooling things to save money overall and to deal with the public good without having the possibility that certain people in that group will have increase in costs.
Oh, individuals.
It says individual.
Okay.
I mean,
no,
it says
individual public purchasers.
But
I read that as in OAB, one school district pays more than another school district as you're pooled together. I mean, to me, that's really not what you want to do.
Ultimately, there isn't any way you can increase a pool that only includes people above average. I mean that's the whole issue. Can you say, let's say you have this pool, you try and put them together for other reasons, the average price is $1,000 for something. Half the people will be paying more than $1,000, half the people will be paying less. You ultimately have to merge them into a pool for the long term benefit of all of them. If you only take the people above $1,000, then you have the same problem. Half of them are above $2,000, half of them are below $2,000. So you're only pooling them above the average. Now you can say, well, you can only take those below the new average. I mean, you end up in a situation where you can't create a pool if the idea is that nobody below average has to pay as much as average.
Well, the assumption in that statement is that they were all equal purchasers and equally adept or deft in their ability to negotiate, and as opposed to their experience.
School District X tells me, one I'm very familiar with because it's one of the three I represent, they're fantastic purchasers. What they are is a very fast-growing school district with all young teachers. So their fantastic purchase is the ability to buy health care for young people at a lower price than they can buy health care for older people. That's the magic of their purchasing.
Well, let's take school district Y.
Y, which may actually be a better purchaser?
Which has two groups of people in different collective bargaining units, and one unit is paying much more to go into a large pool than the other one. who is paying less in the private market, but yet they're being forced or drug in to the public pool. Why would you do that?
If they were such a good purchaser for this group, why couldn't they get the same deal for that group? Because they're older and these are younger.
No.
We'll talk about that. But that is the issue here, and it is not a trivial issue. It's a critical issue as you move towards social insurance models.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would just say I agree that we should revise that last sentence because I don't want us to give any guarantee that there's somehow, if we can't come up with something that's cost neutral for every single public purchaser, that would somehow keep us from going forward on this. I think that would be problematic.
I agree. Okay, we'll work on this one a little further, and we'll see what it looks like when it comes back in a formal amendment, in the form of a bunch of amendments, which means I'll get Tom off and beat him up individually. The advantage of the gavel.
Go ahead.
No, it is stunning to me why someone would say, you're right, I'm going to pay more, and when they can't afford it today, why would I want to pay more to move into something?
Because you have to assume, and this is the point, you have to assume that there are some underlying advantages for creating a larger purchasing pool, and that eventually those advantages will accrue to the whole group. Right now, you may buy it cheaper, your left hand may buy it cheaper than your right hand, but your left hand is still going to pay 18% increase next year, along with your right hand. So we can do something that means 2 years from now you won't be paying that 18%, you'll be paying 8% instead of 18% because of something you've done by pooling your purchasing power together. Then there is an ultimate advantage, but there has to be an ultimate advantage to creating a pool. If there isn't, then there's no point in doing it. You're right. Everybody should go on their own. But you.
Well, I just think, I mean, this whole issue of pooling, at some point, it ends up not giving you any advantage.
Well, if it does, then you shouldn't. If that's the assumption, then nobody should go into a pool.
No, I'm not saying pooling, as in general, is bad, but there's limits to the advantage. At some point, it doesn't matter if you add 10,000 more people into a pool, but still you've reached the max in efficiency.
Yeah, and once that happens, there's no point in bringing anybody else into the pool. Absolutely.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I think one of the things that we might forget, and it would be interesting if we can capture it, is it's more than just the cost of the health care that we hopefully will be more cost-effective and contain costs in some ways, but it strikes me as just absolutely crazy that we have every jurisdiction who offers benefits for their employees has an HR system, spends countless hours trying to figure out what plan they should have. There are cost savings in other realms across, I think, all of the entire public system that hopefully we can realize by taking some of the burden of trying to figure out how you manage your benefits for your employees to some other entity, and I think that's part of the savings as well.
And I have a bill that would do that. It would require the state of Oregon to mirror essentially the federal employees' health benefit and how they pick their plans, how they purchase the plans.
Let's hear it.
I mean, and the contribution piece, which is, of course, is going to be the most controversial.
I'm sorry, what was?
The contribution piece, which is the most controversial. But the federal employee health benefit plan, for example, offers me currently under PEB, I have one option, Regents. That is a system. I have to buy Regents because I live in Josephine County. Under the federal employees health benefit plan, I would have something like 40 options. And various prices and different things, and I'm not quite sure why people pick the plans they pick, but at least you have options.
And with different benefits and a variety.
Different benefit levels based on, but of course the pool is massive.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think if you do it statewide, again, the pool can be massive enough that you can gain those advantages, but yet offer options.
Is that bill coming here?
You know what? I don't know which committee, because it's an insurance issue. It's
yeah,
not
it'll probably go somewhere else. Okay.
Chair Greenlech, members of the
yes,
committee,
ma'am.
Before we move on with this amendment, I feel that in good faith to the coalition partners who did a lot of work on this amendment, I would like to look at the changes that you've all made and bring those back to other folks before we can all agree to sign on to that.
You don't have to agree. We have to agree.
Yes. But just to
that's my concern.
Put that on the record
six
for
votes
everyone
here,
on the committee.
Not your agreement. We appreciate your input, though.
Thank you.
And it will come back as a formal part of the amendment package.
Well,
and Mr. Chair, I asked that those three groups be pulled out, and bringing this back in doesn't concern me at all. And I mean, the reasoning is the rationale.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
I said the rationale for bringing it back in mm-hmm. is completely plausible, and I support bringing this back in.
Oh, good. Okay, yeah, it will be in the package. These things and the ones we're going to talk about Friday will end up being in
Wednesday. And Wednesday.
And that's true, and Wednesday. We are Wednesday have on our agenda to discuss the question of the essential benefit package / basic / minimum. But it's very clear that essential, it turns out essential benefit package means a lot, it has a lot different meaning than minimum. And we're also going to be talking about the expansion to cover kids above 300% of the poverty line. Also, perhaps above, between 200 and 300 and 300 above, there is a proposal that we're calling Kids Connect at the moment that would authorize the board or the exchange to the board, I guess, to create, or the authority, to create a non-subsidized health insurance package for kids above 300% that parents could buy at their full cost, and we'll talk about those. We eliminated the section that would have authorized that, I think, playing with the bill. So those would be the two topics for Wednesday. Friday we'll get to the other four sections.
10, 11, 18, and 20.
18 and 20. And at that point, we'll have the basic set of amendments, that first set that we've been struggling with for a month or so, ready to go to LC, who I understand has been working on it up till now as well, but that should make it easier. So that'll be Wednesday and Friday's agenda.
Mr. Chair, before we can I just review what we just talked about on this package so that I get a sense? In A, the word compromise is going to be changed to include.
Mm-hmm.
We're removing 3 and 4, that's OMIP and the Medicaid Advisory Committee from the list. Number 9 is going to be changed, something along the line of publicly funded nonprofits or majority
nonprofits
funded.
With a significant amount of public funding.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to put dates in 12, 31, 11 in both the second sentence of the first paragraph as well as the last sentence of the first of the last paragraph. And then the last sentence of the first paragraph, we're going to put something in about minimize the increased cost for individual public purchasers or something along that line. And
right.
I'll wordsmith it with Felisa and see if we can come up with something and bring back to you.
No, don't bring it back.
No, I know, but with the whole package.
Take it to the LC, yeah. Okay. Sandy, have we received some testimony, is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Do you want to acknowledge this for the record?
No, you do it.
I believe everybody in their packet received a letter from the Oregon Small Business. They have some recommended language on the board membership options. That's in your packet. We'd like to acknowledge that for the record. And that's all I have right now. And just to add on, you will be getting amendment language that addresses our topics for Wednesday and Friday. I'll be emailing those to you in separate emails tomorrow.
And they'll be available to the public at that point?
At the same time.
Okay. Good. Any other business? 425. We're adjourned.
Such an easy bill.